welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
On January 20th, 2000, the Federal Communications Commission released rules creating a new class of very low-power, non-commercial FM broadcasting stations. These stations would be heard on your radio just like other FM stations, but would have a maximum reach of only 3.5 miles. They are intended to be voices of the community, perhaps creating for the FM band what the public access channel is to cable television. On March 28, 2000, in Willimantic, Connecticut, former radio pirate Pete Treadish spoke about these new low-power FM or LPFM rules and about his experience as a pirate radio operator. Mr. Treadish was on a speaking tour sponsored by the Prometheus Radio Project to help communities in the northeastern U.S. start their own LPFM stations. At the end of this program, I'll update you on recent LPFM-related events and give you contacts where you can receive additional information.
My name is Pete Treadish, and I am coming to you from the Prometheus Radio Project. Prometheus Radio Project is a group, an organization that's devoted to helping groups that want to start small, low-power radio stations in their neighborhood. Primarily organized in the eastern United States, and we've been involved with the low-power FM proceeding for about the past year and a half or so. I was part of a small group of about five people in early 1996 that decided that we were going to start an unlicensed pirate radio station in Philadelphia. We took a good look at the Philadelphia radio dial, and we concluded that there aren't any real meaningful opportunities for community broadcasting in our town. The local college stations had been bought up and were more or less NPR affiliates, and you know, the commercial end of the dial wasn't really an option. And we had heard that there was a movement to try to recreate a new form of community radio, and so there were five of us, and we started with none of us having had any radio experience whatsoever, and we decided that we were going to start a radio station. We decided we would call it Radio Mutiny, and that we would make it pretty much an open access station that would have that would allow for all different sorts of people to come and become broadcasters, and that we would broadcast come whatever may from the Federal Communications Commission. After a few months, it started working, and within about 3 or 4 months of that, our group of five became a group of about 40 to 50 DJs, and we were on the air 7 nights per week, and we were broadcasting all sorts of news and opinion and programming that was available no place else on the dial. We shot for a mix of about 50-50 public affairs and music programming. We never really got there. And some of our shows included just things that you would never find anyplace else, but that were real fascinating. One show on people with disabilities, one show on called Incarceration Nation, which was devoted to watching the prison system and movements in prison reform and prisoners' rights. We had a show called Red Sun Rising, which was sort of a mix of news of the indigenous peoples of this hemisphere and Native American hip-hop, which was actually something I'd never really encountered before. So we operated our sort of our quirky station. We were not necessarily the most technically proficient. Many of us had no radio experience whatsoever. But we had a real difference from what else was on the dial, mostly in the fact that we had human beings coming in and volunteering and giving their time and giving their labor to the station. For most of commercial radio, that's too expensive. to do, and much commercial radio has very little in the way of actual live radio personalities. And, you know, I sort of always likened the, you know, to listen to commercial radio, to me it feels sort of like listening to voicemail or something like that a lot of the time. Very little of it is actually done by live air personalities. It tends to be just sort of audio files that get cut and pasted on computers these days. Anyway, Radio Mutiny existed for about 9 months until in the fall of 1997 we got our first visit from the Federal Communications Commission. At that point, we did what all good groups do when they come under fire from a federal agency. We started arguing with each other, and we tried to figure out whose fault it was. And after a day or two of trying to figure out what our next step was, we concluded that we were going to try to make the most of the situation. So we called a press conference in front of Benjamin Franklin's printing press, which was conveniently located downtown. And we brought our transmitter, much like this one. Actually, I think we brought this one. And we announced that we were going to turn our station back on. We're going to turn around back in front of Benjamin Franklin's printing press. We made this giant banner that said, 1763, Benjamin Franklin defies the Stamp Act and British regulations on Poor Richard's Almanac, or whatever we said. 1997, Radio Mutiny defies the Federal Communications Commission to affirm the rights of free speech and broadcasting. And at that point, we turned our transmitter back on. We dared the FCC to come and arrest us if what we were doing was so wrong right in front of there. And of course, they didn't show up. And also at the same time, we issued a 7-point platform for how we were going to make the FCC's life really, really miserable until they chose to legalize low-power radio and create opportunities for community broadcasting. After about 5 more visits, which I think is a record, the FCC finally came and they confiscated our station in mid-1998. But by that time, there had been a sea change. They pretty much acknowledged that their policies were somewhat discriminatory against, you know, small community groups, and they acknowledged that that their role as guardians of the public spectrum was not supposed to be to guard the spectrum for the rich and the powerful and the institutionally well-connected, but for all citizens, and that they were going to make an effort to clarify their processes and create a new class of licenses. At first, we thought that this was just some sort of PR nonsense on their part. However, as it came closer, and after our station was closed, we chose to take them at their word, and we formed Prometheus Radio Project as an organization to help shepherd in the new service and help either new groups start up or to help, you know, sort of shepherd former pirate stations into being licensed broadcasters. In the midst of this, also there was great opposition on the part of the National Association of Broadcasters. The National Association of Broadcasters is one of the most powerful lobby interests in this country. I believe they have an annual budget upwards of $40 million a year, and they lavish that money around quite generously. And they are, demonstrated themselves to be dead set against this idea, against opening up any more opportunities on the airwaves for community groups. Despite that opposition, on January 20th of this year, we had a minor victory, which was that the FCC did declare that there's a new, it's not no longer a proposal, it is a new set of rules for creating low-power radio stations. And while the rules are much smaller in their scope than what we had asked for and what we had essentially proven to be viable through conducting engineering studies and so on, in any case, at this point, we're trying to work on implementing those rules and continuing in the near future to try to expand those rules. The application hasn't been released, but the report and order from the FCC has made it clear at least a bunch of the basics of what's going to be on it. And the first thing is going to be only organizations can apply for low-power radio licenses. You can't apply as an individual. You need to be an organization that has a board of directors, and you'll need to have a few short statements, like a statement of educational purpose, and perhaps a statement of programming intent, something like that. In order to successfully complete these forms, you really need to channel your inner bureaucrat. Then you'll be asked to certify a number of other questions. You know, one thing that you'll have to certify is that you are not a convicted felon, as convicted felons are ineligible for radio licenses. Although, strangely enough, if you look at a corporation like General Electric, General Electric has a rap sheet that is, you know, just pages and pages long. They've been convicted of all sorts of things. Price fixing, conspiracy to fix prices, tax evasion, fraud, double billing on government contracts, all that sort of thing. Strangely, they were allowed to keep their broadcasting licenses. Of course, they own NBC and a number of television stations, but because their felonies were not broadcast related, they were considered to not be a reason to take away their broadcast licenses. So if you're forming an organization, just try to avoid having anyone have a rap sheet. Although, you know, you can always point to GE if you need to. Then there'll be another couple things. You'll have to certify that you don't own any other broadcast-related property. And the idea is to keep GE's grubby hands off of this particular community broadcast license.
Do you think there's still going to be pirate radio stations?
Well, I think that there will be. I mean, I've chosen not to really be very involved with them at this point because I've decided. You know, one of the key things that made me decide to go the way I was, I mean, from the first, what we were trying to do was convince the FCC to create reasonable opportunities for community radio. And now that they've made that effort, I feel like I'm perfectly happy to play within the rules if the rules are fair. I don't think the rules are as fair as they really ought to be, but I think that they're worth implementing and worth creating. There are a number of pirates that that see the vast number of frequencies that could be used. For instance, on second adjacents in big cities, where the engineering evidence is clear that you really could use them without causing any problems, a number of them will probably go on using those frequencies that they have been using without causing any harm. So it's hard to say. I don't think that pirate radio will have a very successful future in the courts. One of the key reasons that pirate radio did so well was because the rules were so clearly because there were these spaces that were capable of not interfering, and because the FCC had no real way of licensing the use of them. And so some judges, you know, looked at the First Amendment issues and said, not necessarily that the pirates were right, but that their concerns were worthy of consideration, and that caused the sort of legal quagmire that created a situation where a whole bunch of people jumped on the air. That quagmire is going to be closed pretty much by low power FM, and so I think that most cases against pirates in the future will be open and shut. I have a big problem with any pirates that actually, you know, interfere and don't take seriously their engineering and make sure that their equipment is up to the standards that it needs to be. Okay, well, just a little bit about the current political situation for low power. Right now, the National Association of Broadcasters is working very, very hard. They're actually working overtime trying to stop this from going into effect. They are extremely sore that even this very minor reform has been passed. They can't believe that a bunch of freaks and anarchists and hippies or whatever they think we are actually managed to beat them in front of the FCC. They're very unaccustomed to losing. And they have pulled out all the stops and spent millions of dollars trying to stop this from going into effect. Right now, there's a bill in Congress, ironically titled the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act of 1999, and it currently has about 150 co-sponsors. Now is a very, very good time to write your Congress people and tell them that you really want the low-power FM service.
You're listening to Pete Tredish from the Prometheus Radio Project speak about the FCC's new class of low-power, non-commercial FM stations. Mr. Tredish spoke on March 28, 2000, in Willimantic, Connecticut.
I understand NPR is opposing LPFM. What's their rationale?
Well, it's pretty interesting. Every NPR reporter I've ever talked to, not that I've talked to dozens of them, every one of them I've ever talked to has been really excited about this. Like, gosh, I wish I was doing that instead of working for dumb old NPR, you know? But, you know, so actually a lot of people at NPR are actually quite supportive, but there is a thin layer of bean counters that run the show at the top, and they're the ones that decide to court Archer Daniels Midland and, you know, and all this sort of thing. And they are nervous about, you know, they're incumbents. Their interests are the same as the existing broadcasters. They don't want pledge dollars going to other radio stations. They don't want... The one legitimate concern is that they think that, you know, some frequencies that they might have used are going to be taken by this local broadcasting. And, you know, frankly, I think, you know, there's barely anywhere you can go in this country and not hear NPR. And I think that they're completely throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They are basically just hanging on to every option they can to continue to expand and grow and make more of the radio dial theirs. So it's an embarrassment for them, I think, and it's very unfortunate they've taken the position they're taking. Mm-hmm. They won't come out and admit that those are their real reasons. They're sticking to the NAB line about interference and so on.
Mm-hmm. But they still get federal funding.
Yeah, they still do get federal funding.
Any chance that they're worried about?
They sure are, actually. One senator, one congressman at the hearing mentioned, well, if low-power FM goes into effect, maybe we won't need federal funding for NPR. And the president of NPR was testifying at the hearing, well, I don't think low-power FM's a good idea at all, actually. You know, they just sort of showed the organization's leadership's true colors in the matter. There's people that want to do this all over the place. I mean, the low-power radio rulemaking set a record. There were over 3,500 comments. There's never been anything like that. And this isn't just 3,500 people that wrote a letter or something like that, you know, saying, oh, I think this is a good idea. This is 3,500 people that filed like 20 pages of comments saying, well, and I think the antenna should be directional and blah, 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 blah. And it's been striking in its effect on the FCC. I mean, there, you know, the FCC at first was sort of dismissing the whole thing, but then, you know, in the past few months, I've talked to some of the people there, and they're sort of like, I've been here 20 years. I spend most of my time deciding whether Rupert Murdoch can own 20 stations or 30 stations or this sort of thing, and it just doesn't seem to matter. But this is something that so many people care about, and so many people have put... really want to see happen. And so there is there's some pretty significant support for it inside the FCC at this point. And there's also just gobs of people that are getting ready to apply for these. But then there's also the same old characters that have always had too much of the airwaves that are, you know, going to try and scheme and figure out their ways to get their claws on some of these as well. So
Pete, what are some of the deficiencies that you found in the existing radio that led you into pirate radio and LPFM?
Sure. Well, there were a number of them. One of the most obvious and direct events that led us to do this was that we... I live in Philadelphia, where Mumia Abu-Jamal was incarcerated. And Mumia Abu-Jamal, just in case your audience doesn't know, is a radio journalist who is sitting on death row in Pennsylvania for the murder of a policeman who claims his innocence. And he was contracted to do a series of talks, not about his case, but about the prison system in general for NPR. And NPR was very, very excited about him, being on the air, until Bob Dole got up on the floor of the Senate and said that it just so happened that NPR's funding was coming up around the same time, and Bob Dole got up on the floor of the Senate and he said, if Mumia Abu-Jamal gets to do a show on or a commentary on NPR, I'm going to take away all their funding. Mm-hmm. And NPR, to actually no one's astonishment, but to everyone's horror and shock, completely backed down. And so we're just sort of blatantly censored by, political interests. And then again, it happened with our local college station. When Pacifica Network News was going to carry Mumia Abu-Jamal, the local police convinced the college to remove all their Pacifica programming. And so actually, at this point, there's no Pacifica programming in the whole state of Pennsylvania.
Wow, just take Pacifica off the air, not just not broadcast the Mumia's commentary or whatnot.
No, they canceled their whole contract with Pacifica Network. And so those were kind of dramatic things, and we just saw a crying need for, for freestanding radio stations, a station that doesn't owe its allegiance to a college or any big institution or anything, but just a radio station that stood on its own. Its only purpose was to serve as a cultural and, intellectual medium for the life of the city. And so that was what led us into it. About 6 months into it, I got this call from this guy, and he said, are you the radio pirate? And I was like, yeah, sure. Who are you? He's like, well, I own three radio stations. And I was like, oh, what do you want? But then he had something quite interesting to tell me. He said, I've been in the radio business since I was 15, and I worked my way up from sweeping the floors to, doing the programming, to selling the ads, to everything else. Over the years, I've gotten very good, and when it was a mom-and-pop operation, when the boss decided it was time to retire, he sold me the station, and I've done very well in the past couple of years, and I love radio. There's nothing else I've ever wanted to do. But, he said at that point, ever since the Telecommunications Act of 1996, I've realized that I have no alternative except to sell my stations within the next, year or two. Basically, you have an outfit like his. He said to me, I pay for every hour of production that you hear going out over my radio stations. I have to pay the announcer, I have to pay for the, music rights and all that sort of thing. In exchange, I get an advertising revenue for 1 hour worth of, spots. And he said, I know how to make money at that. I'm a good businessman. I do well, I employ people, whatever. Look at an organization like Disney. Disney now owns 100 radio stations. So they make 1 hour of content in their studio in Los Angeles. They put it up over the satellite. They broadcast it out over 100 stations across the country. And they get 100 advertising revenues for paying for 1 hour worth of content production. Not only that, they can get advertisers and advertise in every market across the country, whereas I have to, so every time they convince someone to buy an ad with them, they buy 100 ads, whereas I get one ad every time I convince someone to buy an ad on my station. there's no way I can compete. And I'm just going to have to go out of this business. This business isn't made for people like me anymore. But then he said, well, but I've done radio all my life. I don't want to end up working for the mouse or some big corporation or whatever. I don't know what else I'll do with myself. So I'm thinking that once I sell my stations, I think I'll start a pirate station like yours. And my jaw just dropped. I was just like, what is this? You know, this is the Walmartization of America's radio. And it's a world in which small business can't survive anymore, and in which people that have been on the air for 20, 30 years are getting shoved aside. So much of what is done in radio today is done by computers. It's done by, you know, they have computer programs that figure out that if you have the number 7 song played at 5:21 during rush hour, you'll get your maximum market share and whatever.
What were some of the features of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that made it this way?
Well, it's an interesting thing. So many people have never even heard of this act. It's been called one of the 10 most important pieces of legislation in the court that have been written and passed in this decade, the past decade. So many people never heard about it because, basically because the incumbent media wrote it. There was almost no, in my hometown, it was only mentioned the day that it was passed, and that, I think, was just on the business pages. There was no public debate. There was no real public understanding of what was in this bill. In essence, it was a giant giveaway to industry. And not just to the industry, because there's plenty of small operators that just got screwed, like that guy was. What the key effect it had in radio was, it used to be that there were certain limits on how many radio stations any one company or person could own. It used to be that you could own no more than 20 stations, 20 FM stations and 20 AM stations across the country. Over the year, actually, it used to be that you couldn't own more than 7 and 7, then it was 10 and 10, and 20 and 20. And there was also a limit on how much of a percentage of the market you could own. So it used to be that you could own no more than a quarter of the radio stations in any given town. At this point, you can own up to a third of the radio stations in a town. One entity can own your classic rock station and your all-news station and your country station and your urban hip-hop station. They could very well all be owned by the same person. 2 years ago, there were 10 corporations that owned 50% of all media. Just 10. It's projected that if the current rate of consolidation keeps up, that 3 or 4 corporations may own 75% of all media in the United States within 8 years. So it's very troubling. It's a very troubling thing for a democracy because, you know, as you know, everyone says, you know, the freedom of the press is for those that own them. It's interesting to think about the early history of radio. The first inventors of radio were ecstatic. They were incredibly excited about the potential for this media. You know, they thought that there would be great speeches of learned men on the radio all the time, and there would be an incredibly empowered electorate, and people would become greatly culturally enriched by this new medium of radio. Within 30 or 40 years, one of the inventors of radio, Lee DeForest, made this interesting proclamation. He said, "What have you done to my baby?" Radio has turned into like nothing but a giant flim-flam attempt to sell people soda pop. And none of the things that I thought that would come out of radio have come true.
We've been listening to Pete Treatish from the Prometheus Radio Project speak about the FCC's new class of low-power non-commercial FM radio stations. Mr. Treatish spoke on March 28, 2000. Since Mr. Treatish's talk, the FCC has released the LPFM application. On April 13th, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to prevent the implementation of LPFM as created by the FCC. However, this bill cannot become law until a similar measure is passed by the Senate and signed into law by the President. Senate Bill 2068 has been introduced for this purpose. For more information or to obtain an application, go to www.fcc.gov or look in your phone book's blue pages under U.S. Government Federal Communications Commission. The Prometheus Radio Project can be reached on the web at prometheus.tao.ca or call 215-476-2385. That's 215-476-2385.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.